The next matter on calendar this morning is case number 58255, Blackburn versus State. I don't know if counsel was in the audience when we called the first case, but this is a three-judge panel consisting of Justice Seda, myself, and Justice Hardesty. Justice Seda is unavoidably absent this morning, but she's read the briefs and will listen to the oral arguments and participate in our deliberations. So you're not just getting a two-judge panel here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Almaz, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Cesar Almaz, on behalf of the appellant Frank Kevin Blackburn. Justices, essentially the argument has three facets. First, the legislative history surrounding the statutes 176.139 and 176A.110. From there, there's a plain reading analysis on those statutes. And then finally, the scientific community, the why and how behind the statutes. And specifically, at issue, the term diagnostic tools and, standard assessment. With regard to the legislative history, Senate Bill 99, and I'm referencing Appellant Supplemental Appendix, page 353, there was a discussion with Stephanie Tyler, lobbyist for the Nevada Psychological Association, and she stated that the association was in support of this bill and that the test...
Well, that's an interesting place to start your argument. We don't even look at legislative history if it's not ambiguous. Maybe you ought to first tell us why you believe this language is ambiguous.
Well, thank you, Justice. The reason I'm going into the legislative history is because there is a paucity of case law with regard to this issue. And it's a matter of statutory construction. With regard to the diagnostic tools, I don't believe that there is actually there shouldn't be any clarification needed, but I understand that
What are the competing reasonable interpretations of the language in the statute that make it ambiguous? That's the test.
And I don't believe there's any ambiguity. I think our position is that diagnostic tools refers to the risk assessment instruments, the risk assessment tools which were utilized.
So your interpretation of the statute is that in preparing a psychosexual evaluation, the clinical psychologist is limited to the use of diagnostic tools, period.
No. To clarify, I believe diagnostic tools is to answer the question of whether this person is a high risk to reoffend. That is all. But a psychosexual evaluation contains other things that are needed. The interview process, the review of all the records, interviewing other people involved, that helps call together the information that is used in the diagnostic tools to answer that question. But there are other things that the psychosexual evaluation is used for: treatment, diagnosis, prognosis of the individual in question. And so the term diagnostic tools, I mean to be associated with that question. One of the questions in the psychosexual evaluation, perhaps the most germane question here, is whether that individual is a high risk, moderate risk, or low risk to reoffend. And that term, diagnostic tools, is also interchangeable with the term standard of assessment, which is 176A.110. That term, standard of assessment, again, is bandied about in the legislative history. I don't believe there is any ambiguity there. I bring it up because I know that opposing counsel, the state's position, is that standard of assessment would mean all of those things that are done for the psychosexual evaluation. But the standard of assessment only goes towards the question of whether the person is going to reoffend. Again, there's a litany of things in 176.
I guess what's odd to me is your contention that it's clear and unambiguous, but yet we reach out to alternative sources from the plain language of the statute to try to determine what's included or not included in the word standard assessment.
And simply because...
You want to direct us to legislative history and other sources to determine what's in or out of the word standard assessments. Wouldn't you be better off suggesting that that language is ambiguous and it's necessary to look to alternative sources to determine what is included in standard assessments?
My position, our position, is that there is no ambiguity, but there it's made, the question of ambiguity is at issue here because the other side is stating that standard assessment needs much more than just the diagnostic tools. And because that's at issue, I point to the legislative history, which shows that there is no ambiguity, in fact. They very carefully fashion that phrase, standard of assessment. In Senate Bill 548, the minutes from 2001, there is dialogue, pages of dialogue between individuals regarding standard of assessment. And if I may, Mike Ebright, the district administrator for parole and probation, stated he cautioned there was no way to determine if someone might reoffend. There were instruments that established the probability of that risk. And on the heels of that, Clay Thomas, the deputy chief of parole and probation, stated that standards of assessment, with standards of assessment, there would be levels and tiers to be looked at instead of broad-based terms such as health, safety, and morals, which, by the way, was the phraseology that was replaced during the Senate hearing. The previous statute, the language was not a menace to the health, safety, or morals of others, and it was replaced with the current does not represent a high risk to reoffend. So in that way, it's very, very carefully crafted, the standard of assessment, and it's not open to other means to assess whether this person is a high risk to reoffend. Those other means the interviewing process and the review of the records is used to cull together the information necessary to answer that question, but then also to answer the other questions in psychosexual evaluation, namely, what is the prognosis? What is the treatment for this individual? So it goes beyond just the risk assessment.
So your point, and correct me if I'm wrong, and sincerely I mean that, but you're saying 176, 139 read alone is not ambiguous. It becomes ambiguous when it's read in tandem with 176A, 110, and the reference to standard of assessment in that statute is the ambiguity, or you say clearly favors you. But you're saying it's the standard of assessment that, in tandem with 139, creates this ambiguity?
Well, it's open to interpretation. I don't believe that there is any ambiguity. Once a person looks into the legislative history and...
Well, but we have to get past the statute's wording before we go to legislative history. You can't use legislative history to tease an ambiguity out of a statute that doesn't support it on its face. So what I'm trying to do is understand, I understand your position that it's clear all day long what this statute says and it means that you should prevail. But let's assume I don't accept that. Tell me how the statute is ambiguous in such a way that allows this court to go look at the legislative history you want us to consult.
Thank you, Justice. There is ambiguity in the phrase standard of assessment in itself because it isn't defined. There's no definition within any of the sections that says standard of assessment is to mean X, Y, and Z, or X in this example. Diagnostic tools, I think it's very clear that diagnostic tools in 176.139 was meant to mean risk assessment instruments or risk assessment tools. That standard of assessment, because there was no definition, you are left to look at what is in 176.139.
The question I have with that, though, analytically, is if you accept that standard of assessment doesn't, your argument would really make standard of assessment mean the same thing as subparagraph 4E of 139, which is psychological testing, polygraphic examinations, and arousal assessment. Yet there's a general principle that this court doesn't treat two things as equivalents in a statutory scheme where they appear to be using terms of art without some reason to do that. And I think you're arguing that standard of assessment in 110 equals the catalog of tools in 139.4E. Or not. Tell me why I'm wrong on that.
Standard of assessment is not referring necessarily to subsection E. Our position, my position, is that standard of assessment, standard language refers to diagnostic tools in subsection 3. The person who conducts the psychosexual evaluation of the defendant must use diagnostic tools that are generally accepted as being within the standard of care for the evaluation of sex offenders. And so reading that in conjunction with section 1A of 176A110, the person who conducts the psychosexual evaluation certifies in the report prepared pursuant to 176139 that the person convicted of the offense does not represent a high risk to reoffend based upon a currently accepted standard of assessment. And so I agree with the justice that standard of assessment is a term of art. There is no definition for that, and that's the source of the ambiguity. That's the source of the crux of this issue here.
What would that standard of assessment term include beyond the use of psychological testing, polygraphic examinations, and arousal assessment?
I believe that to mean the diagnostic tools, the risk assessment instruments that are used. Here, the VASOR, the RASOR, Static 99, Static 2002, which are contained within the appendix. Those are specifically designed to answer the question of what this individual's probability risk of reoffense is.
But those are covered, would you agree, by 139.4E?
4E is a separate matter.
Okay.
I believe those tests fall under diagnostic tools, which are mandatory. 4E is discretionary to the evaluator.
Okay.
And that can include polygraph examinations. There's a process or a test called the penile plethysmograph, which it can be utilized, and it's in the discussion in the legislative history that it would be very difficult, certainly in some rural counties, to get that testing. And so they limit it specifically to discretionary testing. But diagnostic tools, I believe that to mean the RASOR, VASOR, Static 99, Static 2002, which are specifically designed to answer that question of recidivism.
I understood a second component of your argument, unrelated to the statutory interpretation, is that even if you assume that the diagnostic tools in this case are not the sole basis on which the recommendation is for high risk to reoffend, could you comment on what appears to be a disconnect from my point of view of the results of the diagnostic tools, which placed your client in a low risk to reoffend, and the recommendation that the defendant was a high risk to reoffend?
Certainly. The low risk to reoffend is based on those tools, and those tools were created over years of study, and there are certain risk factors that they take into consideration. Those risk factors are applied to the individual, and then a scoring is given, and then based on that scoring, they are low, moderate, or high risk to reoffend. Mr. Packholt scored those, and he got that result, but because of external factors, because of things that he observed in Mr. Blackburn or his personal opinion with regard to the offense itself or how he felt about the appellant, he decided that he, in fact, was a high risk to reoffend. I think it's very telling that Mr. Packholt, at a point during the evidentiary hearing below, stated that he's tasked with protecting the public. That's not really his role. His role is to determine what the probability of risk is of reoffense.
You would agree that our standard of review, though, is an abuse of discretion standard by the district court judge in accepting the ultimate recommendation of
Yes.
Mr. Packholt.
Yes.
So in what respect did the district court judge abuse her discretion in accepting his recommendation of high risk to reoffend? What was it about his opinion that was an abuse of discretion by the district court judge, other than limiting his recommendation to the results of the diagnostic tests?
The point of the statute, in my humble opinion, 176A110, and the term standard of assessment refers to the scoring of those tests. And at the point that he departed from and discarded the scoring of those tests and instead substituted his clinical opinion, that flew in the face of the statute. And it was an abuse of discretion by the district court judge.
I understand that argument. My question is, if you lose on that argument, and he now proceeds to divert from the results of the diagnostic test and rely on his clinical judgment, what about the district judge's acceptance of his determination is an abuse of discretion?
I believe the district court judge is bound by the limits of the statute. And under the statute, the standard of assessment is those tools that are employed to determine risk. And so it was error for the district court judge to allow him to substitute that clinical opinion because it goes beyond outside of 176A110.
So, and I'll give you an extra minute here, too, because I'm asking a question. Your position, then, is that all a psychologist can do is come and testify to the results of these administered tests? Is that your position?
There are two ways to answer this. One, there is much more than just determining risk under psychosexual evaluation. There is the diagnosis and the prognosis and the treatment that is necessary. So those are the other things that are included and are needed in the psychosexual evaluation beyond the question of whether this person is a recidivist or his risk for recidivism. And it takes much more than just plugging in numbers. The dialogue that is gained between the evaluator and the individual, the interviews that's done with the family, the looking through the records, it's not as if a person who isn't trained in these things can perform the diagnostic testing or any other part of the psychosexual evaluation. And so it is, I believe, a gross oversimplification, and this was argued below at the evidentiary hearing, to say, well, that's all that's necessary here. It's a very detailed process, and there is more than just scoring points.
So the district court, though, can hear from an evaluator such as Mr. Picault, and he reports on the results of the diagnostic tests, in your estimation. He could separately state his clinical judgment. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But so why isn't that a fair interpretation of what occurred here?
Because under 176A110, it has to be under a standard of assessment that the person was not a high-risk to reoffend. His clinical opinion, his opinion of the individual, the crime itself, and so forth, is needed and should be in the psychosexual evaluation. But it should not impact on the question of whether that person is a high, moderate, or low-risk to reoffend. That's a separate inquiry, limited to the diagnostic tools, limited to that standard of assessment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Danielle Piper with the Clark County District Attorney's Office for the respondent. Where I want to start off is 176.810. In order for a defendant to receive probation under certain enumerated sexual offenses, there has to be a psychosexual. If you look at 176A10 subsection 1A, it refers to 176.139. Counsel is correct where he talks about currently accepted standards of assessment. If you look at 176.139 subsection 3, one of the things that statute says is the person who conducts the psychosexual evaluation of the defendant must use diagnostic tools that are generally accepted as being within the standard of care for the evaluation, and the psychosexual evaluation of the defendant must include a comprehensive clinical interview with the defendant, and B, a review of all investigative reports relating to the defendant's sexual offense and all statements made by the victim of that offense. If you go back to 176A110, the whole point of that statute is we need to find out if this person that may be eligible for probation, what is their risk of reoffense? Are they a low, are they a moderate, are they a high risk to reoffend? When you look at 176.139 subsection 3, those things must be taken into account in looking at a psychosexual. If you look at 176.139.4, those things may be taken into account. Subsection 4 says, the psychosexual evaluation of the defendant may include a review of records relating to previous criminal offenses committed by the defendant, a review of records relating to previous evaluations and treatments, a review of defendant's records from school, obviously in regard to somebody who's younger, interviews of the defendant's parents, spouse, other persons who may be significantly involved with the defendant, or who may have relevant information relating to the defendant's background, and 4E is the use of psychological testing, polygraph examinations, and arousal assessments. In this case, John Packelt used the diagnostic tools that counsel spoke about, the RACER, the VASER, the static 99, as well as the static 2002.
And you concede that those are covered by 176, 139, 3?
Correct.
Diagnostic tools?
Correct. Were you going to ask me another question?
No, I just wanted to nail down where the points of difference are between you and your opposing colleague.
I think the point of difference is where you, after the word and the psychosexual evaluation of the defendant must include a comprehensive clinical interview with the defendant and a review of all the investigative reports relating to the defendant's sexual offense and all statements made by the victim of that offense. In this regard, the diagnostic tools came back as a low to moderate risk to reoffend. John Packelt then interviewed the defendant. He asked the defendant about his sexual history. The defendant talked about how he and his first wife did bondage things where they tied each other up. The defendant talked about the fact that he used prostitutes, that he solicited prostitutes in the fact. He talked about his own sexual molestation that happened. The defendant also talked about things in his, when he was a child, how he had told his parents, you will regret the day that you ever had me. And from that point on, he refused to do homework. At one point, he was actually even illiterate because he refused to do what his parents told him to do. There were allegations of sexual abuse between his daughter and himself, as well as his stepdaughters and himself. The defendant also talked about the facts of the case, which are contained in 176.139B. John Packelt had all of the investigative reports that we have in this case. He had the entire, it was about 3 pendaflexes of the state's case. The facts of this case are, in some sense, horrific. Not because somebody actually got sexually assaulted, but because of the preparation that the defendant took in regard to this case. He picked up a prostitute at Boulder Highway. He got her.
We're familiar with the facts of the case. The statutory analysis is more beneficial.
And so in that way, and even when we had the evidentiary hearing, he talked about how even though the defendant came back as a low risk on those diagnostic tools, when he did the clinical interview with the defendant, and he also spoke to the defendant's psychiatrist, Dr. Duffy, there were things that the defendant did not tell him. The defendant did not talk about the fact that he was suicidal. In fact, he denied ever being suicidal. The defendant said that he never had problems with appetite or sleep. Dr. Duffy said he did. The defendant did not disclose the fact that there were incidences of domestic violence between his wife, his current wife, and himself, as well as he also did not disclose the fact that he had abused meth. Dr. Duffy, and this would be covered in subsection 4 of 176.139, also said that he terminated defendant's treatment based on the facts, but also there were issues in regard to defendant's treatment and management of medication.
Counsel, if the court were to accept your approach to the interpretation of the statute, then this takes us to the question I was posing to your opponent, which is when the clinical psychologist departs from the recommendation of the diagnostic tools or the findings of the diagnostic tools, what is the role of the district court judge in accepting the opinion? And what is the standard of review by us in looking at the district court judge's determination about whether to grant or not grant probation based upon that recommendation?
I guess the standard of review would be abuse of discretion. But at this point, my position is he did not depart from 176.139 subsection 3.
He departed from the results of the diagnostic tools.
Correct.
And the diagnostic tools are required to be used by the legislature. The legislature is saying, when you undertake these psychosexual evaluations, we expect you to use these tools. in this case, the tools produced a result that would permit him probation. The clinical psychologist said, I disagree with the outcome. The judge said, I accept that opinion, and I don't grant you probation. I sentence you to prison. We're now asked to review that decision. It seems to me that it needs to be more than a guess as to what the review standard of review is.
I guess then it would be an abuse of discretion.
So if it's an abuse of discretion, did the district court judge in this case make findings that the clinical psychologist's conclusions that diverted from the tool results were supported by any substantial evidence?
Yes.
Okay, what were the judge's findings?
The findings were that Mr. Packold, under 176.139, had interviewed the defendant. And in the interview of the defendant, as well as the review of the investigative reports, that deemed him to be a high risk to reoffend.
Well, I was hoping to find something more substantive, like the clinical psychologist's decision to divert from the tool was based upon this fact, this fact, this fact, and this fact.
Well, I think it was the fact.
Should the district court judge have to do that when they're going to divert? And if they don't, how do we review their decision for abuse of discretion?
And let me ask a third question that
we're piling on.
We're piling on, but it fits. The third piece is whether in this particular case where there was a prior reversal and remand for this, was it not particularly necessary that we receive findings such as Justice Hardesty just outlined?
Yes. And, of course, now you've caught me where I don't remember all the findings. There were findings none the judge did, or I think the judge did issue. I know she did issue a detailed decision in regard to this case. I do not remember, to be honest with you, those findings as I speak. I know that a lot of it was based on the evidentiary hearing that we had, and a lot of her decision was based on what Mr. Packold said in the clinical interview with the defendant, as well as based on the facts of the case. Those were the reasons that he deemed the defendant to be a high risk to reoffend. And in answering Justice Hardesty's question, although the state's position is he did not deviate, if this court is asking me if he deviated, the diagnostic tools come back low.
Well, you don't dispute that he deviated, that Packold's opinion deviated from the results of the diagnostic tools, do you?
No.
Oh, all right.
No.
Well, the findings are on page 324 of the record. I read those. They don't seem to offer any specific insight by the district court judge as to what it was in Packold's opinion, or what it was from the clinical interviews, or what it was from the events of the crime that supported the conclusion of the deviation from the diagnostic tool.
Okay.
Do you understand the question?
Yes.
Okay.
So in other words, wait, let me make sure I understand. If the diagnostic tools come back as a low moderate risk to reoffend, there also is a clinical interview done and a review of all investigative reports as is deemed necessary under 176.139. And those two things, how you use the word, are in disconnect, the facts and the diagnostic tools. Should a judge...
No, I'm saying that the results of the diagnostic tools are different than Packel's recommendation and findings.
Okay.
So when they differ, shouldn't the judge determine what is the basis for that difference?
Yes.
Okay.
So that
and make findings with respect to those differences.
Yes.
And are those findings contained in this order?
Clearly not.
So what do we do now?
I don't know. I guess you can send it back for her to do findings.
A second time?
Well,
okay, thank
I don't
you.
Know what to say about that. I mean, You could, or the option is not. I mean,
can we examine the record ourselves and determine, since this has already been there before, that the record supports Mr. Packle's recommendation? Wouldn't your argument be today, court, the findings may not be fully supported, but the record is there to support it?
Correct.
And would you then point us to where in the record Mr. Packle's opinions are supported?
I would say in the evidentiary hearing that we had. In the evidentiary hearing that we had, and I'm going to point to, because I was not given my own respondent's appendix, but I would say in appellant's appendix, volume 1. I would correct that. It's in volume 2, I think it is, pages 207 to 321. That's the evidence.
We've read the transcript.
So maybe I don't understand.
So what is it about the testimony contained in the transcript pages? What do you point us to that supports Mr. Packle's conclusion?
I think the fact that
we've read the transcript, we know that.
I apologize.
That's all right.
I think it's the fact that all the things that I was starting to say, where he talked about how the defendant had problems, I think, with sexual abuse, how he was into bondage, solicitation of prostitutes, how he himself had taken a kind of different approach when it came to his parents, the fact that there was allegations of sexual abuse between his daughter and himself and his stepdaughters. And when asked the questions, the daughter said at first she paused, and then she said no, and then later she said, I don't want to talk about this, and she refused to answer the questions. The fact that the defendant took methamphetamines, the fact that there were issues where he did not admit certain things, all of those together, I think, support the record for a high risk to reoffend.
And I had cut you off earlier. We were focusing on the law, but the circumstances of the crime as well, I think, were articulated by him as a basis for his clinical judgment, although that's in tension with the tests.
But I think the facts of the case and all of those things together, the fact that the defendant or the appellant in this case was not forthright with the evaluator, I think is a huge thing when you're trying to determine whether somebody is going to reoffend. Because at the end of the day, it's about public safety. And I understand that this court needs to have some type of standard, and we need to have something that we can evaluate. But all of those things taken together, the facts of the case, what the victim said. The victim, when she testified at the preliminary hearing, and Mr. Packle read that, she told this man when he put a knife to her neck and said he was going to kill her and take her up to the desert and do what he wanted. She specifically told him that her daughter's birthday was that day because she wanted him to know that if he killed her, somebody would come looking for her, that she was not going to be a victim who was going to be forgotten. And so I think when you look at 176.139 subsection 3, that's where, even though the diagnostic tools showed that he was a low risk to reoffend, in the clinical interviews and the things the defendant did not admit to, as well as in the investigative reports and the testimony that he read from the victim, I think that together is why he came up with the high risk.
I've pressed you on this point, counsel, because there is an open issue in these kinds of disputes. When I was on the district court bench, we would get numerous sexual evaluation reports. Some of those, the clinical psychologist would deviate from the diagnostic tests and recommend, in some instances, even a low risk to reoffend. The question that this case raises for me is, what is the district court judge to do when there is a difference between the results of the tools, assuming we interpret the statute in the manner in which you advocate, and the conclusions reached? And it seems in those circumstances that you have to look at what it was that the psychologist relied upon, not only in the interviews, the credibility of the defendant, but also the circumstances of the crime, as the statute talks about. That's what I want you to talk about.
No.
I think you've done it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until 11:30.